Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, frequently ranked as one of the greatest metal bands of all time, Judas Priest have sold over 50 million albums. Their image of leather and spikes and other taboo articles of clothing were widely influential during the era of glam metal in the 80s, and their album British Steel is named by many as the record that defines heavy metal. Main man lead singer Rob Halford is the legendary frontman of Judas Priest, known as the metal god by his devoted global fan base, I'll have you know, and he's written an hilarious and heartbreaking tell-all book. It's called Confess. It's a compelling and very honest look at the struggles he's faced with addiction and his sexuality, as well as exploring his music and his many brushes with controversy, the most controversial revolving around one of the most senseless and tragic stories in the world of popular culture over the past half century. So where to start, Rob? And thanks a million for being with us on the programme. Let's go for 1977 and Sin After Sin. Do you think there was something that happened there that you literally found your voice, and there was a pre-Judas Priest there and a post-Judas Priest after that?
That's a very interesting question, Dave. You know, the thing is, as I've lived a longer life, gained some wisdom, and I look at music in general, you find that for the most part, a lot of bands, a lot of artists, do start to get their footing by their second or third record. You know, and that was the case with Priest. This was the first record that we'd made with a major label. Prior to that, was a small independent label. So this was a major label. We had Roger Glover.
From Deep Purple,
producing us. So all of the components of making a band and a band that was growing were firmly getting into play. So there's something to be said about that for sure, Dave.
Okay, but like, you weren't the real leather S&M kind of guy. You weren't one of those, like, even though you wore the leather on stage, etc. I mean, I remember in 1979, I remember you played here at Dalyman Park, and I was actually doing the stage announcements, and you go up on the motorbike. I hadn't known about the motorbike before that, because a lot of people didn't know. Like, we didn't have the way we can see things so easily now. And when you went up, the place went crazy. But when you did the voice, when you actually started to sing, they went four times crazier. To hell with the motorbike.
You know, that's a very, very strong memory that I have from that show. Metal memories is what we call them. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, that whole image of the band that was developing along with our music, what was very important, it was creating a real foundation, you know. And as far as the voice, yeah, a lot of singers, even now, like on the last Firepower album, Andy Sneap, Tom Allom, they were encouraging me to use the voice in a slightly different way that I've not done before. You can never stop learning. It's an instrument. But yes, that's a good memory. And I'm glad you've remembered it too, Dave.
And just on them, I'll just stay with the voice for one more bit, because how much do you think your high voice actually shaped the drama of the songs? Because you did get a vocal coach for Fight, didn't you?
Well, for the most part, it's all self-taught. And that's the glorious thing about music. A lot of the music that we love comes from musicians that have kind of found their own way. Yeah. And particularly for a lot of singers, you know, growing up as a little kid, I was a sponge. I absorbed all of these great, talented singers as I went into my teen years, and then discovered that the voice was so important to me that I wanted to be a professional singer. But yeah, you know, I mean, again, you can never be encouraged enough. And I'm blessed that I've got a voice that can do some pretty dramatic things. And for certain pre-songs, to be able to go into that upper high range is very valuable.
Yeah, and like, as you say, you grew up in a blue-collar steel town, let's say, and we're talking the Midlands car industry here. If you think about it, Judas Priest, you know, Rob Halford, not necessarily political, yet your biggest hit, Breaking the Law, is kind of anti-Thatcher, Midlands car industry wrecking thing, isn't it?
Well, it's definitely a reflection of the times. It's not so different to what we're going through right now, Dave. I think you might agree. You know, history has a tendency to repeat itself in politics, certainly. But that time, it was tough. It was tough back in England, especially with what Thatcher was up to, and all of the coal miners were on strike, the steel workers were on strike, The bin men were on strike. It was a very It was a very disruptive time for everybody, and naturally that seeped into some of our writing at the time, and Breaking the Law was a bit of a kickback to that, because you had a perfect example of a lot of people coming out of school or going into college or coming out of college, university, you know, they'd been led to believe that they would be having these opportunities and they were being deprived of them. So I think that was just part of the place that the band was at that particular moment, in the lyrical sense. I take responsibility for breaking the law because those are my lyrics. And we very rarely touched on that kind of political platform. But I think, again, it was an important thing to say. And it's become a mainstay in the Priest repertoire now when we play out live.
Yeah, but I mean, you did tackle the psychological and philosophical traumas in a lot of the songs and that. And you yourself were going through a hard enough time. I mean, pre-coming out as gay, did you enjoy being the lead singer and being out there and the writer of one of the biggest bands around, Judas Priest, or did you always have something that was so dishonest to yourself that it always got in the way? Did you, like, basically, did you live your life for other people and just left it that way?
Well, that's great. You nailed it there at the end of your question, because you do. Until you break out and you proclaim yourself and you find self-love, and you realise that this is your life and that it's best lived on your terms and you can find the balance and harmony, then you can take that out into the world. But yeah, you know, the music sustained me in those times. As a gay man that was hidden firmly away in the leather closet, so to speak, it was tough. It was tough. I wasn't able to be myself and to express myself the way that I felt I needed to. And it was difficult. You know, it's difficult for any of us that are struggling with sexual identity, no matter where you are in life, because there's so much going on in your mind about the ifs and whys and wherefores. But it was tough. But yeah, the music definitely sustained me and got me through a lot of those difficult moments.
And overall, you have had a lot of loneliness throughout most of your life. But having said that, what you did when you came out was the best thing you could possibly have done. And you really wish you had done it before that.
Absolutely. And I think most people like myself would agree with what you've said, Dave. It's a fact. It's a fact. You stop living a double life. You're able to get away from all the kind of stories that you have to make up and the innuendo and then the kind of sniggering behind your back attacks, all that fades away. It bounces off you. You know, it makes you a stronger person.
And was it the typical rock thing when you were just doing it, as in the studio, in other words, making albums, and the road, the studio, the road, the studio, the road?
Oh, yeah, I love it. Still doing it now, 50 years later, Dave, doing it now. Yeah. And again, it's what we are. It's what we're about in this beautiful band, Judas Priest. You know, we can't do it again without our fans. We always give a massive shout out to our beautiful fans that have given us the drive and the purpose. It's one thing to be a creative person, but you need your fans. You need people to look after you, because it's an exchange. It's a relationship. And in music, it's a very powerful one because of the emotions involved.
Okay, Confess is what we're talking about here. It's an amazing book, really. Just, in fact, there's one review of the book I noticed, and it does hit the nail on the head when it says it's just about, you know, it's the most wide open and honest since Andre Agassi. And his was wide open and honest, I can tell you. We're talking to Rob Halford here, Judas Priest. So, Rob, let's just take a look, before I get back to who you are, to take a look at just some anecdotes, because there's just so many in the book. For instance, let's go to Mykonos for a while. Freddie Mercury, right? Tell me about... I mean, did you see Freddie there, and was Freddie friendly? Was he good? Was he nice?
Oh, you know, it's one of the things in life that I wish I could turn back the clock, because I've been a massive Freddie Mercury fan ever since the band began. I saw them in their very early touring. Saw them a number of times in Birmingham, back home. But we never got to be friends per se. And that's something that's a little bit, you know, bittersweet for me, being such a fan of him especially. The story is that we waved to each other across a crowded gay bar in Athens as we were all on our way to Mykonos. And then the next time I'm on the beach, lying on the beach, and I see this big, big yacht that he'd rented, and it was covered in pink balloons, and it had all these guys dancing around, and you know, Freddie came into view and he's waving at us and we're waving at him. And then he floats off into the sunset. Very dramatic, like Freddie was. But I think I know him like we all know him, with the beautiful messages that he sent in his music.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would say they never really got an. And he also didn't do that many interviews. He let Brian May do so many of them. But let's take a look at something more supposedly, possibly mundane. Two supports you've done. You opened for AC/DC. And you used to always, like if you were a support band, you often left the venue early. But you got an invite from AC/DC to go for a drink or whatever it is. And Angus has one glass of champagne and he's legless.
Yes, he was. I saw that happen before my very eyes. And it was remarkable to watch. What a great bunch of guys. You know, in music, we have each other's backs, as the expression goes. And yeah, they were so kind and generous. They thought we were legging it after every show and thought there was something going on, some friction, and we tell them no. Yeah. We had to get in the van and drive, in some cases, overnight to be ready for the next venue.
Of course, yeah.
And then they said, come on, lads, get on the tour bus with us, you know, because they had more money than we did in those days. And they had this lovely big tour bus. So that's just the generosity of the boys, you know, and we're still good friends.
Right. Any generosity from Led Zeppelin? You open for Led Zeppelin?
Yeah, Robert Plant, out of the blue. We get a call at the end of a very, very long, long tour of America. We'd been touring for months, playing every kind of venue, every club, every pub we could, because we were building our base. And then he calls us at the end of this long, long, grueling tour. We got our tickets and ready to go to the airport and come home. But he said, we want you to open up for us at this two-day stadium event, Day on the Green, in the Bay Area in San Francisco, Oakland, 80,000 people a show, and you don't say no to that. So no. We've got a cheap flea bag motel by a motorway, and waited there for a couple of weeks before we got a chance to play that show. And another great connection with friends that we have in music, and of course Robert being a local lad.
Yeah, exactly. Special exactly. For us all. Yeah, indeed. Yeah, and also like you met Lady Gaga. You had a bit of an awkward encounter, could I call it that, with Madonna?
Oh yes, yes. I'm covered in tattoos, as you may well know, mm-hmm. And she was quite curious as to where they went and and what direction they went in, and. Let's just say that the tattoo adventure ended at the appropriate time. She was a lovely lady. I'm a big fan of everything that she does, in and out of her music. She's a great humanitarian, but that was a very kind of unexpected encounter with Madonna.
I'm just thinking, if the Queen of England had asked you where do all those tattoos go to, would you have gone all the way and shown her?
I absolutely would. She's my Majesty. She's Her Majesty.
Tell me about meeting the Queen. What was that like? What'd she say to you?
Spectacular. Yeah. Spectacular. I've always loved the royal family. I admire them. They're a family, like we all have families, you know, and they've been very open in the recent years. Here I am, a lad from Walsall, going through the Buckingham Palace gates, going to a celebration for, at the time, 25 years of UK music, and by myself, because you couldn't take anybody with you, because they wanted to keep it, you know, kind of compact. But, you know, I go upstairs, it's the big music room, and I'm looking at all these beautiful paintings. A lot of my friends were there, Brian May, the lads from Status Quo, Kate Bush. It was amazing to look at all of these beautiful people. And then the equerry comes over and says, would you like to meet Her Majesty? And you don't say no to that as well. So, of course, the other side of the story, Dave, is I'm there with Cilla Black.
Oh, right.
I linked up with Cilla because Cilla was by herself sitting on the sofa. Yeah. And I'm like, that's never Cilla by herself. So I introduced myself and we had having a bit of a chit chat.
You had a blind date with Cilla, did you?
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. And we were joined at the hip. So Her Majesty comes over and I reach out to shake Her Majesty's hand, which you don't do. And Cilla's digging me in the ribs with her elbow, saying, don't shake hands with the Queen. And anyway, we had a bit of a chit-chat, and Cilla goes, he's come all the way from Finland because he's on tour with his band. And the Queen goes, oh yes, what kind of music do you play? And I said, it's heavy metal, Your Majesty. And she goes, oh, heavy metal, why do they play it so loud? And it's because we have to bang our heads, Your Majesty. Oh yes, very good. And then she wanders off to the next person.
Well, I heard so, she smiled regally.
Oh yes, she's always got that beautiful, gracious, regal smile. It's magical, magical.
There's so many. I'll drop another name here. I think you were maybe backstage or touring with Alice Cooper. I'm not too sure which, but you met Johnny Depp, and something you didn't know about Johnny Depp.
Yes, I mean, again, what a great man. He's a phenomenal actor, and he's a very, very good guitar player. He goes out with my friend Alice and the band, the Hollywood Vampires. And I try and do a yearly charity thing that Alice does for a great foundation that helps a lot of kids here in Phoenix. And Johnny Depp's there, and we get a chance to have a bit of a chit-chat, and he invites me to his dressing room. And it turns out that when Judas Priest was over in Miami making the Screaming for Vengeance album, there used to be a club that I used to hang out called the Treehouse, where I'd go and jam with the bands. And Johnny goes, "I was there, you know." And I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Yeah, I was there." I said, "How come?" He goes, "I was just like this skinny, long-haired kid, and I had my own little band, and we loved Priest, and I was a big fan of you, and I used to sneak in and watch you jam with the other bands." Mm-hmm. So who knew?
Just one other name I want to mention here is, how did you end up getting handcuffed to Andy Warhol?
Well, he got handcuffed to me.
Oh, yeah, right, of course, Your Honour. Yeah,
because we played an after show. We had a couple of dates at the Palladium, which is a big venue in New York, and then the label wanted to throw a bit of an after show party, which we attended and played some songs. And I see this little guy with a shock of white hair, slowly moving around with this little camera, taking pictures, and I'm singing. And at the same time, I'm thinking, "Oh my God, that looks like Andy Warhol," and sure enough, it is. So afterwards, he comes and says, you know, introduces himself, "Hello," and what have you. And he's looking at my regalia, and he's looking at the handcuffs, and I take them off, and I put one cuff round him and one cuff round me. And I go, "You know, I've lost the key, Andy. I don't have the key." And he's like, "Oh, really? Oh, really?" And we were joking around. But after that, because he was a man of few words, a remarkable man, Andy Warhol, man of few words. But I did find the key, and then he and I went in, hailed a yellow cab in New York, and went off to Studio 54 together. So all of these, I can't believe I've had such a blessed, glorious life, and I want to share as many of these stories with my fans and my friends as want to be.
Well, you have done in this remarkable book, Confess. But just a few things have been like, you know, there are many random sexual encounters in truck stops across the US on it as well, and you write these all in. You're completely honest. Has anybody expressed any, like, they're offended or shocked or anything like that?
Well, you know, opinions are what they are, aren't they? And and because I've been clean and sober now for over 35 years, my goal in life is to be as truthful and as honest and as open as I possibly can. All of these things in the book have made me who I am. Some of them I'm not proud of. Some of them were dangerous moments. Some of them were risky moments. Some of them were foolish moments. But that's what all of us in life have made choices that we would reflect on and say, "I wish I could have done that differently," or "I wish I could have said that differently." That's human nature. So I'm just being the guy that I am and putting it all down there in black and white for you to have a look and a think about.
Okay, but, like, you know, when a fan asked you to sign something back in 1981 and said something that was obvious that you were gay, was that one of the, "Wow, like, somebody knows" kind of thing? I mean, like, you're playing to 10,000 head-banging metal maniacs every night or whatever, and then you struggle backstage with, you know, basically, as I said earlier, denying your true self, if you like, and you're off stage yearning for love. It's very difficult and it's not happening. When you decided to do what you do, did it help you in actually your work, and did you struggle before that?
Well, this is a great song. This is this song called Raw Deal from the Sin After Sin album that we talked about at the start of our chat day. You know, that's become quite a catalyst in many ways. I've always had to kind of bring it into the question that that was never kind of part of an agenda on my part, as like, "Oh, I'm going to write a song about a gay place in New York called Fire Island, and that'll send the message out that I'm a gay guy." This was just a bunch of words that I put together for a song that motivated me and created that emotion. The remarkable thing about it was, for decades, nobody really picked up on the story or the message. And it was a shock to, it was not so much a shock, I was pleasantly surprised when at a record store this one chap said, is that about a gay place in New York? And I thought, oh, well, at least somebody's got the idea of the story. But it's become a very important moment in terms of reflection for what the message in that song contains.
And do you have friends who are deeply closeted and that works for them? Fine.
Absolutely. I've said all along, if you choose to stay where you are and you're living your life and it's and you're healthy, mentally healthy, and you're okay with it, then that's your choice.
But for you, hold on, Rob. I mean, do you think that for you it was just fear? Fear of either rejection from the fans, because we're talking here in a pretty strange culture of metalheads in some ways, or a fear that the band might kick you out?
A little bit of both. Well, that's not fair to say the band would kick me out, because they knew I was a gay going from the moment that we got together.
Yeah, right.
However, it's true to say that, yes, I was deeply concerned, because I thought that if I did make that statement, or if I was caught by the paparazzi in a gay bar or whatever, that could have adverse effects on the band and our fans and following. Because, as you know, back in the 70s, it was a different time. It was a different experience, even through to the 80s. You know, there was a tremendous pushback to the LGBTQ community, and so I was doing everything to protect the band and the great hard work that we were putting in to step up the ladder every so often with our tours and our records. And that is the case, I think, for a lot of people that are struggling with that closet. You're more concerned and fearful of rejection, and you're fearful of creating a fuss and a mess, when you step forward. And, of course, eventually, when I did step forward, I realised, although time had advanced and there was a little bit of a better perception on people like myself, that fearfulness was not really ever called for.
You know, funny thing is, just finally one or two bits, and that's while that's very well put, I get the impression that while you've had a fantastic 50 years on the road making music and playing to thousands of people every night, etc., that you know overall loneliness has been right up there at the top through most of your life, hasn't it?
Well, it has to an extent, yeah. And I didn't realise that. I didn't realise to what extent it had been until, you know, I was doing the audio book, speaking the words out from the page, and then it was starting to hit me, you know. And again, it's just a remarkable, I won't say it's a survival story, although there's a little bit about that, especially with my alcohol and drug abuse, and, you know, that I came to the end on one occasion, almost came to the end of my life on one occasion. But, you know, I have to keep reinforcing this fact of there, but for the grace of God, go I, because as I've grown older and, you know, again, gained more wisdom, I realise that the spiritual path that I've been on has also been there with me since day one. It was something that I wasn't aware of, but I've only since my clean and sober days been able to tune into all that.
Well, Rob, in 1990, and you know what I'm going to talk about next, where it all went very strange, so bizarre, so weird, so you couldn't make this stuff up. You were across every single newspaper across the world for all the wrong reasons, and yet it was nothing to do with you. Where two kids decided you would put subliminal messages onto an album, it went to a court case, etc. It influenced two teens to attempt suicide. Tragic, tragic ending to the story as well. How did that affect you? And, like, was it really difficult?
Yes, we were shocked. We were shocked. We were offended that the suggestion that we would use our music to create that kind of possibility was just too fantastical to even consider. We'd had no clue that it was going to go as far as the day in Texas when we got off the tour bus and the sheriff gave us a subpoena. And these lads from the UK had to fly all the way to Reno to fight for our lives in music, you know. But we were determined to have our say. And, of course, in the opening days, it was very apparent that these two beautiful lads that lost their lives were huge fans of Judas Priest, and music was their outlet, you know. But you mix that up with the dysfunctional family and all the other troubling things that they were going through as young men. And it's just like a... It's just like this ball of chaos, and I honestly don't feel even today that they intended to do what they did.
Yeah,
I think that something happened, something triggered, something, whether it was a game or what, it was just a horrible, horrible tragedy. But anyway, there we were, you know, doing what we did and representing ourselves and representing the heavy metal world and so forth. We had a great bunch of people working for us. And the judge, who was completely open to the whole discussion, was very straightforward and took all this information in. And the only sad part for us, I think, Dave, as it still is now, is that the judge left the door a little bit open, you know. He still couldn't quite grasp what this subliminal message thing was. And he still couldn't grasp what this phrasing of the way I was breathing and this idea that this expiration of breath was saying these words, do it, you know. It's just crazy. It's crazy. Do it. Do what? Wash the dishes, mow the lawn. It certainly isn't kill yourself, you know. So it was just a very unfortunate time for us. But we got through it. And, you know, the band carried on. But it always is in the back of my mind, will this ever happen again? Please, God, don't let that be the case.
All right. And just finally, just on that note, just the whole idea of this is a mundane question, but did it affect and change your writing, even saying, wait a minute, I better not write that just in case?
Well, here's the crazy thing. I didn't even write Do It.
Yeah.
But I certainly take your question that, yeah, you would think that in thinking this through and going through this grueling 1 month process of having all these wild accusations, that you might change your thought process as a lyricist. But I said, no, I'm a strong believer in doing whatever you feel is right for your band, for your music, for your art, and expressing it the way that you feel is the honest way of showing yourself. Yeah. And then it's up to you. It's up to the public. Then it's up to your fans to either accept or reject what you do. And so, no, it didn't. It never entered into my mind that I should change that way of writing my words.
Well, Rob, listen, congratulations on 50 years of Judas Priest and an absolutely hilariously brilliant and fascinating and very heartbreaking, as I say, account. Right, it's all there, all of human life in Confess. It's such a great book. Thank you so much, Rob Halford, for talking to us on the programme today.
It's been a great pleasure, my friend. Stay safe, wash your hands and wear a mask.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.